From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is an extraordinarily powerful industry, extraordinarily well connected, and has one advantage over all the thousands of other special interests. They control who gets on the airwaves, and there's no better example of raw power in this country than that for a politician.
Media Money, the National Association of Broadcasters, begins their national convention in San Francisco. They say micro-radio interferes with their business. Media activists believe the NAB interferes with their democracy. Also, a report from Jeremy Scahill in Yugoslavia and part two of our discussion about women in the presidential campaign. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last night in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, a massive rally. More than 150,000 people jammed the streets to hear opposition presidential candidate Vojislav Kostunica deliver his final public speech before voters go to the polls on Sunday. As we've said before on Democracy Now!, most foreign journalists are being denied visas to cover this election. But Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill is in the capital city of Belgrade and files this report.
The last public rally of the democratic opposition of Serbia before Sunday's elections lasted just over an hour. Tens of thousands of people packed the streets of the capital city, singing this song, which has become the anthem of the opposition, Save Serbia from Asylum Kostunica. Many times throughout the night, the crowd chanted, He's finished, he's finished, referring to Slobodan Milosevic. Vojislav Kostunica wove his way through the crowd, shaking hands and greeting his supporters, before taking to the stage for what many here say was one of the biggest nights of his political career. Kostunica told the crowd he's a man of the people, one of them. He said he's not trying to change the world, but to create what he called a normal life for the people of Yugoslavia. Perhaps the sharpest moment of the night came when Kostunica invoked the wars of the past 10 years in the country. He spoke specifically of the more than 250,000 Serbs expelled from the Krajina region of Croatia in August 1995 by the U.S.-trained and backed Croatian military in attacks the New York Times called the single largest ethnic cleansing of the war. He continued his nationalist attacks on the Milosevic regime, saying his more than 10 years in power had brought the eyes of the world on Yugoslavia for the wrong reasons.
These things brought us wars in which we were not quote-unquote engaged, but in which coffins kept coming to this country. These things brought us refugees, first from west to east and now from south to north, from Ukraine to Serbia, then from Kosovo to Serbia. This regime created the border between the Serbs of Serbia and the Serbs of Bosnia on the river Drina. These things have brought us isolation, sanctions. They brought long lines, anxiousness, insecurity. They brought uncertainty into our lives. These things brought us the capitulation to NATO after last year's bombing that was proclaimed a victory by the Milosevic regime. These things brought us to the situation today in Kosovo, where we have foreign troops and a foreign administration. And now those who enabled foreign troops to be in Kosovo say that they will be those who will chase that army from Kosovo. Those who brought them to Kosovo will not take them out. All of those things, that misery, that suffering in our lives, that concentrated especially in the last 10 years, they made all of Serbia and this great gathering in Belgrade finally wish for some peace and tranquility.
Over the past 2 days, Slobodan Milosevic has given more public speeches than many observers remember seeing for a long time. He traveled to Yugoslavia's junior republic, Montenegro, yesterday, where the government of Milo Djukanovic has allied itself closely with the United States and Western Europe. Milosevic told a crowd of more than 20,000 people he would resist efforts by the U.S. and other countries to try to further divide Yugoslavia by encouraging Montenegro to break from the Federation. Last night at a rally in Belgrade, Milosevic accused the opposition here of being NATO colonizers who are provoking crime and terrorism in Yugoslavia. At all events here in Belgrade, one thing is abundantly clear, and that is the absence of large numbers of foreign journalists. Many have been denied visas to cover the elections. But for Democracy Now!, I'm Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
We are lumping, just a bumpkin to the corporate state. You can't satiate what you can't negotiate. Your will's been snatched, the bill's attached. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. A mine is a profitable thing.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the National Association of Broadcasters is having their annual convention in San Francisco. And you're saying, what do I care? Well, the next president of the United States will have received more than $1 million from media companies. Activists around the country are gathered to protest at the NAB meeting, the NAB meeting, because NAB is leading the charge against low-power FM radio stations. And NAB has tremendous power. Since 1993 through the middle of this year, media companies have given $75 million in campaign contributions. Among the largest corporations that lavish big bucks on the major candidates are Time Warner and Walt Disney. And today we're turning to Chuck Lewis, who is head of the Center for Public Integrity, who did a big study with the Columbia Journalism Review of media money and the power of the National Association of Broadcasters. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thanks.
So tell us why this group is so significant and could well affect people's lives.
Well, they have Capitol Hill Wire. Well, the most powerful special interest today in the United States, and we've been tracking these special interests, as you know, for about a decade, is the media, because not only do they give tens of millions of dollars, or as you just noted, $75 million to be exact, just in the last 3 or 4 years, and the leading person, the leading entity is the National Association of Broadcasters. Not only do they give tons of money and hire hundreds of lobbyists collectively, they control whether or not politicians will ever be seen or heard from in this country. And that's power. And so if you look at legislation over the years, there very frequently nothing ever is passed or comes out that will hurt the media in any way, and they usually get what they want. I mean, there's no clearer, more famous or infamous example of this than the digital spectrum giveaway a few years ago, where they basically got a $70 billion government-owned, public interest-owned access to airwaves that they could make huge sums of money from, and they got it for free. And the media didn't cover it. It was basically ignored by the national news media, which, of course, was going to benefit from this giveaway.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Chuck, because I was at the White House then going to the press briefings, and I questioned Mike McCurry about this and asked about this giveaway to the corporations that they get what's worth, tens of millions of, what is it, billions of dollars?
Billions, yeah.
Billions of dollars for free.
Right.
There, let's just say, was not much follow-up questioning from the representatives of the corporate media who were getting this boondoggle.
No, exactly. And that's the same issue that we found in this. We did a five-month investigation with half a dozen people. We found that frequently corporations don't want to discuss what they're doing. Now, there are a lot of, for example, just a quick example, it's not just TV and broadcasters. Family-owned newspapers fighting the so-called death tax on estates. The Copley newspaper chain and Cox Enterprises and Morse Communications and others paid $1 million, and they tried to make sure that legislation, that law became history and toast. And basically what happened is they wrote editorials to their readers saying this is a terrible law, never once revealing that they were spending $1 million to kill it themselves. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that's going on, where they have a powerful economic interest and they're not acknowledging it or covering it. And it's, you know, it's just frustrating. And the best example of all, and the one that we led with in the Columbia Journalism Review, and is the free airtime for politicians. As you know, today, politics is not covered very much. The last 3 months of the 98 gubernatorial race in California, 1/3 of 1% of all the news on the airwaves out there, only 1/3 of 1% was actually political news covering the race. Meanwhile, broadcasters are going to make this year nationwide $600 million from political ads. It's the third leading source of revenue for their local stations. And so what's happening is they're not covering news, but they're making huge sums of money, unprecedented sums of money from TV ads. And why does this matter? Well, five media corporations and the National Association of Broadcasters spent $11 million to kill campaign finance laws, legislation that was proposed that would give free airtime, mandate free airtime to cover politics. So this is an example that affects our daily life. That means you'll never see much about the candidates in any news programs. And it means that if you're a candidate running for office, you have no choice but to spend, raise tons of money, which of course some people are not able to do for various reasons. You have to be a millionaire or be able to raise these huge sums of money, because paid media is the only way you're going to get before the voters. And of course the broadcasters well understand this and are, as Paul Taylor, the head of a group called Alliance for Better Campaigns, calls it, profiteering from democracy. It's really quite stunning. And all of what we're discussing hardly at all is covered by the national news media today.
You open your piece called Media Money in the Columbia Journalism Review, saying how in his 1998 State of the Union address, President Clinton said, "I will formally request that the Federal Communications Commission act to provide free or reduced cost television time for candidates." Days later, powerful broadcast corporations and their Capitol Hill allies managed to halt this historic initiative in the Senate. And people may be surprised by this. Senator John McCain of Arizona, yes, the man called campaign finance himself, the Commerce Committee chair, led the charge to legislatively block the FCC's free airtime initiative. McCain gets more money than any other senator from the telecommunications industry?
That's right. Roughly $600,000 or $700,000 over the years. But the rest of that story, it's really quite telling. So here's the President of the United States, the first time in U.S. history, saying that he's going to ask the Federal Communications Commission to actually mandate, provide a system to have free or reduced television time for candidates. Days later, it's dead as a doornail. And we interviewed Reed Hunt, the former head of the FCC, who said that the agency and the White House got rolled, quote-unquote, rolled like a pancake. And William Kennard, the head of the FCC who succeeded Hunt, it was humiliated. Basically, he was told in no uncertain terms, not only by McCain and another Democrat, John Dingell, but about roughly 17 Republicans, including the leading names in the House of Representatives, that in essence, you better back off from this proposal or we're cutting your budget. Well, if you're the head of a regulatory agency, that is the scary. Those are the scariest words you will ever hear or want to hear. That's your worst nightmare. And so they shelved the whole proposal, and that's how policy works. If it doesn't become part of the agenda, in the case of this agency, it doesn't enter the quote-unquote rulemaking process, then it doesn't happen, and the status quo continues. And that's how lobbying, of course, works. All of these media entities spent $111 million since 1996 to do just these kinds of things, and all of them affect our daily lives. Virtually all of them are not going to be reported anywhere in your newspapers or on your commercial television stations.
We're talking to Chuck Lewis, Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity, longtime investigative journalist. Okay, how do these media corporations win friends and influence people?
Well, some of this is just amazing. They took members of Congress in the last 4 years on 315 trips all over the world, and no one took more trips or was taken on more trips than Billy Tozan, who's a chairman of the subcommittee that regulates broadcasters. Tozan was taken, he and his staff were taken on 40 trips, or one out of every 8 trips that members of Congress and staff were given. Trips to places like Paris, you name it. And so, anyway, that's one way they did it. The other thing, which we were quite taken aback by, we thought, just for curiosity's sake, we would check to see the Federal Communications Commission staff. I mean, this is the regulator that regulates this industry. We discovered that there were 1,400 trips that staffers at the Federal Communications Commission were taken on. The regulator themselves are traveling around the world on the nickel, not just broadcasters, but the entire media corporation industry. So the trips are one way. Of course, lobbyists is another way. Another way is hiring former FCC people. And we, you know, our study, which is called Off the Record and is available off of our website at publicintegrity.org, where you can get a paper copy from our offices here in Washington. We talk about the number of people who used to work at the FCC who now work for the media corporations. Of course, a well-known problem in Washington, the so-called revolving door. But everything you've ever heard about any other industry, the tobacco industry, the chemical companies, you name it, the media corporations do the precise same things. They also employ the biggest name lobby firms, law firms, both on the Democratic and Republican side. They have the brother of the chief of staff to the president of the United States, named Podesta.com. That firm is retained by a number of the media giants, and so is Haley Barbour, the former chairman of the Republican Party. I could go on and on, but all the big names, all the blue chip names, are all employed helping the media one way or another make billions of dollars, and sometimes it really truly is at our expense.
Chuck Lewis, looking at your report, Time Warner is number one. Media giants spent more than $4 million lobbying last year. Then Walt Disney. You've got AT&T, Viacom, Seagram's, Comcast. I got familiar with Comcast because it was the name of the convention center for the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles. And then, of course, DreamWorks and Rupert Murdoch. And you say that the National Association of Broadcasters is among the top three sponsors of the all-expense-paid jaunts. They're meeting in San Francisco. What do you think that, I mean, it's a joke to say that the corporate media should be looking at right now in San Francisco, but maybe you can introduce us to our next segment where we're going to have media activists who are furious that NAB has led the charge against increasing competition and allowing low-power FM stations around the country. What does that have to do with campaign contributions?
Well, The head of the National Association of Broadcasters is a close personal friend and former college roommate of Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. And
this is Eddie Fritz.
Eddie Fritz. And the NAB is extraordinarily well-wired on Capitol Hill. And, you know, it is the broadcasters' trade association, and it is one of the most powerful in the city, as I said before, not only because of the money and the lobbying, but because of the power of the message being controlled out there. So
you also point out 20 registered lobbyists at NAB, 7 of them come from the congressional staffs, FCC, Federal Trade Commission. Until recently, Mississippi, Louisiana Congressman Billy Towson, his daughter, Kimberly Towson, was
right,
one of them.
For the NAB, right. No, exactly. I mean, so talk about an incestuous mess here between this particular industry association and the Hill. I mean, these guys are in up to their neck on the Hill with the broadcast industry's people. And so the idea that that these powerful broadcasters are not going to get their way on any issue, everyone should disabuse themselves of that notion. Generally speaking, it doesn't happen. There's very few examples where the broadcast industry has, you know, been assessed for some basic problem and not seen something coming, and, you know, had a problem in Washington they couldn't solve. And so that might be the backdrop to what's going on in San Francisco on that specific issue. But the bottom line is this is an extraordinarily powerful industry, extraordinarily well connected, and has one advantage over all the thousands of other special interests. They control who gets on the airwaves. And there's no better example of raw power in this country than that for a politician.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Chuck Lewis, Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity. It's based in Washington, website publicintegrity.org. And phone number?
202-466-1300.
That's 202-466-1300 for the stats. I want to say the corporate media should give a call. There's some remarkable stories here. I won't hold my breath. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about the issue that's going to bring many out to the streets outside the National Association of Broadcasters annual conference in San Francisco starting today. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, as members of the National Association of Broadcasters began their three-day national convention in San Francisco yesterday, activists from around the country began descending on the city to protest the association's aggressive stance against low-power FM, or micro-radio, and to demand increased non-commercial, locally controlled public interest media in this country. Under an FCC headed by William Kanar, the first African-American FCC chair, media activists had successfully lobbied to end its 22-year ban on micro-radio, despite intense opposition from the NAB and NPR, National Public Radio. The FCC began its ban on LPFM in 1978 as a result of pressure from NPR, which wanted to consolidate its audience. LPFM activism has grown gradually since. Earlier this year, the FCC announced a new licensing plan that would effectively enable as many as 700 new low-power community stations to take to the airwaves. While many activists feel the plan does not go far enough, the NAB aggressively opposed the law entirely and used its influence in Congress to see a bill passed in the House that squashed the FCC plan, and if passed by the Senate, would reduce the number of stations nationally from 700 to 70. The NAB says the micro radio interferes with business. Activists say, and our guests today say, the NAB interferes with democracy. We tried to get the NAB on today, the FCC and NPR. We were not successful, but we did get on Robert Perry, who joins us in the studio from the Center for Constitutional Rights, a lawyer representing LPFM activists. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert Perry.
Hi.
Let's start off by telling us what low-power FM is.
Low-power FM is a form of radio that in which stations broadcast, as it says, as at low power. The FCC has authorized two classes of low power stations. One will operate at 100 watts of power with a coverage area, I believe, of 3.5 miles, and the second will operate at 10 watts of power with a much smaller coverage area.
Petri Dish joins us on the radio from Philadelphia. He's with the Prometheus Radio Project there, but he's out in California right now for the NAB protests. Tell us what the Prometheus Radio Project is and what it has to do with NPR.
Well, the Prometheus Radio Project emerged from folks in the micro radio movement who were working on getting the low power FM service started, and we have over the years been advocating for not only for Low Power FM but also for media democracy in general. And at this point, you know, now that we got the service passed by the FCC, we're working to protect it from the various ravages inflicted upon it by Congress, and eventually to expand it to make it to make room for more stations on the dial.
You were shut down by the FCC?
I was part of a collective before Prometheus existed. I was part of the Radio Mutiny Collective in Philadelphia, which was an unlicensed radio station.
And what were you trying to do? How did you broadcast?
Well, we broadcast out of a friend's house, and we broadcast 7 nights a week with about 60 programmers, and we basically saw our unlicensed broadcast as an act of civil disobedience against the way that that the media is owned.
What were you broadcasting?
Oh, it was everything from, you know, klezmer to hip hop to, you know, local activists doing public affairs shows. And it was real exciting because there's really nothing like a neighborhood radio station to, you know, sort of form the nexus of you know, new ways of creating local democracy.
So what is NPR's role in all this?
Well, NPR's role is unfortunately really shameful. And I'd like to, you know, differentiate between all of NPR because there are lots of folks at NPR that actually support this. And sort of thin layer of imperious beam counters at the top of NPR who feel very threatened by the possibility of low-power radio. NPR has been pushing stations across the country to take its sort of nationally syndicated programming and eliminate their local content. And as a result, you know, low-power radio starts to look like a more of a competitive threat because there really is a lack of local programming on these NPR affiliates. So they have never had the guts to admit their real policy objectives about this. They've always couched their opposition to Low Power FM in terms of technical issues. Mostly they claim that there are certain kinds of interference that can be caused. The truth of the matter is that they lost on the technical merits of their argument before the bodies that were most able to judge them, which is, you know, the engineering staff of the FCC. Actually, they were highly successful. They managed to go from a service that was proven to be able to have perhaps 2,000 stations down to what we have, which is around 700.
Saying that micro-radio stations cause interference in the signal.
Right. And now they, you know, that wasn't enough for them. They want to further reduce the service to make it, you know, pretty much meaningless. So what they've really been looking for is they're looking for a venue to present their arguments where, you know, where the technical merits of their arguments don't matter, but you know, the normal workings of money and power do. And so they chose the United States Congress, an appropriate venue for that sort of argument.
Janine Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, based here in New York, but you too are in Berkeley right now for the NAB protests. Can you put this in a larger media context?
Well, yes. It's important to understand the NAB and the large corporate media's objection to low-power radio in a context of really their attempts, and since the NAB has been in existence, they've always been about thwarting any alternatives to the model of broadcasting that they promote, and that's the commercial advertising-driven model. You know, the NAB really see the airwaves not so much as a public resource to be shared the way we might, but as a private preserve where they have to protect their investment value. And when it comes to low power, Petri Dish is absolutely right. The problem is that low-power radio is often providing just the kind of locally focused issue news that commercial radio is pretty much given up on. The FCC deregulated radio in 1980 and said that they no longer had to provide news and public affairs. And a lot of stations jumped right on that to the point where now, in most of the top 75 markets, the radio stations don't even do their own news. They outsource it to another entity, and the NAB, rather than trying to curtail that kind of activity, one of the panels at the NAB conference here in San Francisco was originally titled How to Sound Live and Local Even When You're Not. So, you know, the problem is the NAB has always been about thwarting any kind of alternative model of broadcasting.
Are we talking dead man talking?
I'm in a payphone.
Uh-huh.
Well, us activists are living rough out here. But the NAB has always been about thwarting any kind of model of broadcasting that might put the public interest more central.
Robert Perry with the Center for Constitutional Rights. What are the legal issues here? And is the battle over in Congress right now? Are they even going to pass 70?
I can't tell you what's going to happen with the Senate bill, but as you probably know, the House passed a bill that would significantly water down the FCC's already watered down low power radio proposal.
Going from 700 low
to
power
70,
stations
yeah.
to 70.
And a companion bill has been introduced in the Senate, I believe, as a rider to a appropriation bill. The NAB has also challenged the FCC's low power report and order by filing a lawsuit in the District of Columbia, United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And that case is has already been briefed, and the oral arguments will be held in late November. I might add that the Center for Constitutional Rights has also filed a lawsuit that's been consolidated with that lawsuit on behalf of a former member of Steal This Radio, the unlicensed station that formerly operated on the Lower East Side, Greg Ruggiero. And we're challenging the FCC's decision to automatically disqualify from holding LPFM licenses or participating as an officer or director of a licensed LPFM station anyone who refused to cease unlicensed operations after being told to do so by the FCC. Now, Petrie mentioned a few minutes ago that a lot of these unlicensed operations were acts of civil disobedience, challenging what people felt was an unconstitutional rule, the FCC's former ban on low-power radio. And the analogy has been made to the civil rights demonstrations in the 50s and 60s. Those people broke the law in order to vindicate their First Amendment rights. Rosa Parks, for example, sat in the front of the bus. What the FCC has done is analogous to eliminating discrimination in the South, but then saying that Rosa Parks can't sit in the front of the bus because she broke the law in the past.
So she's the one who can't sit, but other people can.
Yeah. So these unlicensed stations, the courageous unlicensed stations that paved the way, that forced the FCC to adopt low-power radio, are essentially shut out of licenses.
Well, all of you are up against some powerful foes. We were just talking to Chuck Lewis, head of the Center for Public Integrity, who put out this report, Media Money, which is in Columbia Journalism Review. And he says no media organization spends more money lobbying or has more people covering Washington than the NAB, which has spent more than $19 million to persuade government officials since 1996. The NAB president, Eddie Fritz, was a college classmate and close friend of Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, and on occasion this relationship has been immensely helpful to the broadcasters. There are 20 registered lobbyists at the NAB, seven of whom came from congressional staffs, the FCC, and the Federal Trade Commission, and until recently their ranks included Kimberly Towson, the daughter of Billy Towson, who is the Louisiana congressmember who takes, I guess, more junkets from the communications industry than anyone else. Petri dish, you are up against a lot.
We sure are. But it's also exciting because this is a sort of a new moment for media activism. I made my way all the way out here because, you know, for a long time, you know, the paradigm of trying to affect the media environment of this country has had more to do with writing letters to the FCC, doing studies, and so on. And certainly some people have taken more steps. But with the emergence of low-power radio and with these demonstrations here, we're seeing a sort of a new level of activism where people see media concentration of ownership, the lack of localism in media, as an issue in and of itself, not just a side issue. And we're really looking forward to building a larger movement that can confront these issues, because they really, in some ways, they seem a little abstract, but they really go to the heart of every other issue that we fight, because the media has so much say over the process of shaping public opinion and affecting our public policy. And as long as activists have to pull some crazy media stunt or something to get 5 seconds on the air to express their views, as opposed to the pundits that go every night up on Nightline, there's never going to be a balanced debate about these public policy issues.
Can you tell us about the schedule, Janine Jackson, in these few days outside of the NAB conference? And are you planning to get inside? And how many people do you expect in San Francisco?
Well, if you talk to some of the organizers, they put it in the thousands. Some people are less hopeful, but we do expect it to be one of the largest scale demonstrations around media issues that we have seen. So it's a little unclear how many people are making their way out to San Francisco. We do know that thousands and thousands of people are following this issue from wherever they are. Well, there's going to be a series of teach-ins and music concerts. There's going to be a press conference this morning at 8:30 a.m. outside the Moscone Center. There's also going to be some workshops on how to build and operate a micro-power station. We did send a letter to the NAB saying that we would love to come inside and address, let them know what we're out in the street shouting about. We've got a tentative response from them that some people might let us in to do that. We're not quite sure, we'll believe that when we see it, but we have made the attempt to talk directly to the members. And then on Saturday, there's going to be a big rally and a march starting at 4 p.m. The rally's going to go from UN Plaza to Union Square, where there's going to be a big independent musicians concert. So folks can find out exactly what's going on from Media Alliance's website that they've set up specially for the protests, which is www.mediademocracynow.org.
I'm looking at the postcard for the protests going beyond low-power FM, protesting, squashing grassroots media efforts, putting out the trash called commercial radio and TV, and even pushing through the overall Telecommunications Act of 96, which it says legalized media monopolies, creating the Gap and Starbucks of the airwaves. Petri dish.
One other event is that on Saturday, there's going to be the initiation of a hopefully short campaign against NPR. NPR, unfortunately, has been the linchpin of the opposition to low-power FM, and we are going to hold a press conference outside of their board meeting, which, strangely enough, is in the same hotel as everything else that the National Association of Broadcasters is doing. And we're going to be calling on subscribers and listeners to NPR to hold back on their pledges until they change their policy on this issue. We really hate to target public radio in this way, but again, we don't see any other way to get them to stop blockading low power radio at this point.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Petri dish of Prometheus Radio Project in Philadelphia, Janine Jackson with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Robert Perry with the Center for Constitutional Rights, a lawyer representing LPFM activists. Again, we did invite on the FCC, NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, and NPR, and did not have any luck in all of those cases. That website for more information on these protests, www.mediademocracynow.org. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, part two of our discussion on women and presidential politics. Included will be some of your comments, listeners from around the country. We'll be joined by the National Organization for Women, as well as the Black Radical Congress and the Feminist Majority. Stay with us.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We now turn to the second part of a look at women in the presidential campaign as George Bush and Al Gore continue to woo the vote of women. The United Nations yesterday released its annual report, which said that women the world over get a raw deal in comparison to men, whether through physical abuse, double standards, or discrimination. United Nations Population Fund said that rape, abuse, and bad laws are just some of the barriers oppressing women, with no country free of prejudice. Yesterday, we put out our comment line and got some comments from listeners around the country.
My name is Lynn James. I can't think of one feminist organization, general feminist organization, that has supported the promotion of black women to leadership positions.
Basically, I was wondering how the National Organization of White Women is getting over their image. So I've never seen them take a stand when the Kennedys were accused of rape, but they were right there when Mike Tyson was. So what I'm wondering is that when are they going to open up the National Organization of Women to all women instead of just Caucasians?
I'm calling from New York City. I'm listening to BAI. I'd like to ask your feminist panel tomorrow how they can justify the barbarism of partial birth abortion.
This is Sandy McMillan, Long Beach, listening to KPFK. I want to present a few facts that I'd like the panel to respond to and then tell me why they're not supporting the only real hope we have for the entire range of women's issues, Ralph Nader. It was a Republican appointee who wrote the Roe v. Wade opinion. The only justice opposing it was a Democratic appointee. There's been another Republican appointee, Senator Dale Connor, who's been the strongest proponent all along. There was another Republican appointee, Souter, who just recently wrote a reaffirming opinion. In addition to that, after Al Gore's acceptance speech, he told the press that a reproductive rights would not be a, quote, litmus test for any Supreme Court appointee of his. And also, the fact is that statistics show, and there are several reasons for it, it's been much more difficult for a woman to obtain an abortion under Clinton Gore than it was under either of the previous Republican administrations.
Just a few listener comments from yesterday's discussion. We turn now to Loretta Kane, Action Vice President of the National Organization for Women, Helen Neville, Associate Professor of Black Studies at the University of Missouri and a member of the Black Radical Congress, and Eleanor Smeal, Executive Director of the Feminist Majority. Loretta Kane, a few comments about the National Organization for Women, concern about them not representing people of color.
Yes, good morning. Well, I think that, first of all, we need to acknowledge that the feminist movement generally and the National Organization for Women in particular is very committed to serving all women, regardless of race or class or sexual orientation or any of the other differences that there may be between us. It's the case, I believe, that too often we allow ourselves as progressive people and as oppressed people to be divided against one another. Now has a very strong record on working to combat racism. A third of our board of directors are people of color, women or people of color. We have worked to bring women of all races together in women of color and ally summits to talk about how we work on our issues, on feminist issues, on women's issues in a way that is representative of all women's concerns.
And what is your major focus now in this election year? As both Gore and Bush, Bush says the W, George W, stands for women, are really pushing hard for the women's vote. They both went on Oprah in the last week. They're focusing on prescription drugs, talking about women.
Well, you know, we have launched a bushwhacker campaign now has. We believe the W stands for worse. When it comes to women's rights, he's the worst candidate. It's clear that he has an anti-women agenda. He's sugarcoated his rhetoric in with his compassionate conservatism line, but that is just sugarcoating. He's said as governor of Texas, he's commented that he would do everything in his power to restrict abortions. As governor, he signed 18 anti-reproductive freedom provisions. Texas rates among the top states in the U.S. As far as the rate of violence against women committed with guns. He opposes all hate crimes legislation. He's against the inclusion of sexual orientation in any civil right and in any civil rights and anti-discrimination or hate crimes laws. He supported a bill to make it illegal for lesbians and gay men to adopt children or to serve as foster parents. One out of six Texans live below the poverty level. Texas ranks second worst in the nation for women without health insurance. Nearly 2 million women in the state did not have health insurance in 1999. It's worst in the nation for the percentage of children living without health insurance. And he has named Justices Scalia and Thomas as the Supreme Court justices he most respects. He's clearly not concerned with the issues that are important to women in this country.
Eleanor Smeal, Executive Director of the Feminist Majority Foundation, the last listener calling in, said, let's look on issues of abortion that people raise as perhaps a defining issue for the campaign. With Roe v. Wade, it was a Republican appointee to the Supreme Court who was the author of the Roe v. Wade decision. And that if you look at what's happened with abortion in this country under the Democrats, people should be deeply concerned.
Well, that was, let's face it, Blackmun, when he wrote the decision in 1973, that was a totally different Republican Party, you might as well say. The issue of abortion was not polarized as it is today, and it wasn't taken over by the Christian Coalition and their ilk. So the party, the Republican Party, has shifted and put into their platform in the 80s, a total anti-abortion stance. And so everything's changed. By the way, yesterday on the program was said continuously that, the women's movement had conditioned their position on abortion since 73 and always had made the court the issue. That's really not the truth. I mean, we started by winning the court, the Supreme Court victory 7-2, and we really didn't even think that this would be an issue at the turn of the century. It really becomes this situation that we're in since the Reagan-Bush years. And really, it's not, when we say it's the court, it's not just on abortion. It's a whole host of issues. I mean, you have a possibility of losing tremendous civil rights and women's rights gains. Remember, affirmative action decisions have also been extremely narrow, 5-4. You just lost the Violence Against Women Act, 5-4, the civil rights provision in it. And, of course, you have gay rights, which have been turned down, 5-4. So, basically, it isn't one issue with the court. It's numerous issues, as the right wing has so taken over, especially the congressional party of Republicans, to the point that they are sitting on and blocking black and African American and Hispanic and women appointments to the court, because it's not only the Supreme Court, it's all the courts. I mean, it's the entire federal branch where appointments have been held up of all more progressive and especially women, African American, Hispanic judges. So it's a much more complex issue than a single issue.
Helen Neville, Associate Professor of Black Studies at the University of Missouri and member of the Black Radical Congress, your response to that, the overall issue of the courts going well beyond the Supreme Courts, that the shift could take place in this election and the difference between Gore and Bush?
Mm-hmm. Obviously that we do need to take those reactionary kind of decisions into consideration. In addition, though, to some of those court decisions, some of the things that we, as part of the Black Radical Congress, as well as the Black Feminist Caucus within the Black Radical Congress, think we also need to take a holistic approach to looking at liberation of women. So looking at the court decisions, which were outlined earlier, but also looking at certain policies. And I think that is really critical. And some of the policy issues that we're concerned with are issues that are concerned with everyday women, working women. These are the women who are doing the bulk of our work, whether it's paid or unpaid, women who are working as cooks, women who are taking care of our sick, women who are teaching our children, and really trying to create legislation to protect those women. And one of the critical issues that we see as important is really having a national living wage and implementing that. We believe that that will be critical in alleviating some of, not all, but some of the oppression that women experience. And obviously, when we talk about women of color, we're talking about people overrepresented among the poor. Like a third of black women are living in poverty, and almost 45% of black mothers are poor. These are people who are struggling to take care of their children. Obviously, has a profound impact for people's lived experiences.
Do you think they've done any better under the Democratic administration than previous Republican administrations, although we've got both now with Congress and the executive branch?
Mm-hmm. I think in terms of some, there have been some gains that have been made, but when we talk about some of the gains that the Democratic Party has discussed, which is gains in wages, gains in that I think we need to be critical about, because workers in general make less than we did in 1979.
Yeah.
In fact, our minimum wage is almost a quarter to a third less than it was two decades ago, taking into consideration inflation, you know, controlling for inflation costs. So while I think that there's gains, that those are the gains that people are articulating are really hidden, and we are making some steps backwards that we need to bring to the fore and talk about.
But can I get in?
Eleanor Smeal.
Yeah, I mean, on, for example, living wage and minimum wage, you know, Senator Kennedy has been pushing to raise the minimum wage, as has, you know, the Democratic leadership in Congress. I'm not really just harping party here, but they really have been, and it's been blocked by this right wing.
You know, I mean, it's interesting, though, Eleanor Smeal, just a quick point on that. I remember when the Republican Revolution of 94 came in. Uh-huh. In fact, the Democrats had not increased the minimum wage, and they made it an issue once the Republicans came to power.
Well, but
they
but
could
they,
have increased it before, and they hadn't.
One of the masks are is that, you know, essentially there are four parties right now. You have the right wing of the Democrats, the left wing of the Democrats, the right wing of the Republicans, left wing of the, not the left wing, but a more moderate wing of the Republicans, which is really fading. And when the Democrats had a so-called majority, it really wasn't, because you had the Republicans plus the conservative Democrats of the South holding up everything. Now you've got those that boll weevil right wing Republican, and actually the committee chairs, and so it's even worse. I mean, one of the things that is good is the right wing of the Democratic Party has decreased some, because they've switched to become Republicans, so at least you can see them. But basically, the crowd that has been pushing for this is now in positions to be much stronger. I mean, for example, you've seen how many African Americans will become committee chairs and subcommittee chairs if the Congress would change. And they've all have consistently been pushing for raising the minimum wage as well as Kennedy. The reason I mentioned Kennedy is because he's the ranking member of Labor and Human Resources, and he's been consistent on that.
Let me bring Loretta Cain back into the discussion from National Organization for Women. Are you concerned about the increase in God talk of the presidential candidates? I mean, Lieberman is really pushing this, and now Gore is saying it more, and of course George W. Bush is right in there with a lot of references to God.
Absolutely. It is of concern. When Senator Lieberman was selected as Vice President Gore's running mate, our comment was that while he wasn't our dream candidate, he wasn't our nightmare either. He has been consistently supportive of reproductive rights issues, but we do have concerns about the in the whole political atmosphere, there is this rush to God, And we seem to be backing away from our commitment as a country to freedom from religion as well as of religion. And you do need to have both. So that is a concern to us. And I think that it's very important that we all speak very forthrightly about the importance of maintaining the separation of church and state. Of a greater concern, I think, is that George W. Bush is ready and willing to turn over all of the social welfare programs in this country to religious organizations, toss in the prison industry in this country. He would love to have that run by religious organizations. And I think that's way scarier than the God talk that we've been hearing from Lieberman, when we at least have a commitment from Vice President Gore that he would not mix things up in that way.
You mentioned dream candidate. Do each of you have a dream candidate? Helen Neville?
Actually, no. I don't have a dream candidate in terms of who's running now.
Who will you be voting for, by the way?
I haven't actually really decided who I'll be voting for. I think that I definitely will not be voting for Bush and not for Gore. I don't believe that they are addressing the critical issues facing our nation. I do think that one nice thing that Nader talks about is he begins to talk about how our society is structured and really looking at critiquing globalization and the devastating impact of global capitalism on our workers, on people's lived conditions. And I think that is really critical, questioning corporate welfare and not whether or not people are receiving types of public assistance. However, Nader falls short in his articulation and conceptualization of looking at specifically explicitly also women's issues and people of color's issues. Hasn't been coming to the forefront on talking about racism and sexism.
Helen Neville, I have to leave it there, from the University of Missouri. Eleanor Smeal, Loretta Kane, a name of a dream candidate? We have 10 seconds. Either want to venture there? Okay. Eleanor Smeal, Executive Director of the Feminist Majority Foundation, Loretta Kane of Now. And by the way, speaking of the of Nader, the Presidential Debate Commission, there will be a protest outside of the commission today in Washington, D.C. for excluding third-party candidates. That does it for the program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230. Special thanks to Greg Ruggiero, also Deepa Fernandez. Our engineer is Matthew Finch. Our producers, Jillian Aldrich and Sidra Franklin. I'm Amy Goodman from the studio WBAI in New York. Thanks for listening.